Thank you very much, Vicky. But oh, the trouble you've got me in. We've got four presentations, each worthy of their own Q&A session, and we've only got 20 minutes. Where to begin? Well, you begin by texting your questions in. I might start, though, where we've just finished, on the broader question of the industry and trust and innovation. You nailed it. We were talking about trust yesterday, and there was a focus on the small percentage of people who don't have a happy claims experience. No, why would I trust an industry when I don't understand who's making me a good offer for health insurance? Why would I trust a health insurer who was still charging us for pregnancy insurance, and we're kind of beyond that now? That level of trust and innovation, how do you get it through to your members to start innovating for the clients, not their bottom line?
You're asking me? Gosh, wow, where do I start? I think from the perspective of the Insurance Council, we talk to our members daily. And as I said, I remain optimistic. There is an awful lot that's going on. So I am optimistic. And I think what the ICA can do, we can sort of almost act as a dumping ground for all of the angst and anxiety that's coming out of regulators, the media, you know, the commentariat, if you like, and filter that through to our members and where it's appropriate, create that collective conversation within the industry to try and identify where we can, where we do need to do better. So I think there is an awful lot going on. And I think what I'm trying to say is I hope that the industry has heard the message loud and clear and action is being taken.
And your example of innovation, listening to the customers, my favourite innovation story is a woman called Daniela Greenwood, who works for an aged care mob called R-Care. They're big in Victoria, you might have heard of them, who won a prize for innovation because she decided to listen to the clients and their families and the staff and change the rostering system to a relationship-based rostering. You've got to go Google and find out what I mean, but totally change it. There are no more bed sores. Absenteeism dropped. They don't use casuals in their dementia wards anymore. People are happy. The only technology involved was the computer that typed up the roster. Is that perhaps the biggest payoff for this industry in the near term, while a lot of technology is still coming? Dealing more honestly with people in the culture of insurance.
So I'll probably come in there. So yes, I think the whole sort of topic in around innovation is used in terms of new technology. But to your point, the innovation and applying innovation exists today in terms of the way that we operate. And I think there is this whole movement across, you know, a lot of corporates in terms of that very point, is the customer connection, understanding what really is driving what people want, and then amending the way that the services are provided. Now, there's also lots of challenges with that, with the historical systems, but this is where the APIs and the ability to actually change quickly, or partnerships in terms of how you can actually bring in some other expertise to enable the speed to deliver, is really going to see this industry start to change and change very quickly.
Let me jump then from the human factor. And didn't I hear that today? You get rid of human beings, you've got no more problems. You probably didn't really mean that, no. But can I jump to the technology side then, for both Guy and Sam? The technology is here or about to come. The black box in your car already knows if you've been speeding when you have the crash. Your mobile phone, never mind the Uber driver's maps, your mobile phone company knows if you're having an affair. To what extent does that Internet of Things and the desire for control and information get over some barrier that we're not ready for yet?
So obviously, in my point of view, I think there is a fair bit of regulation to come to resolve those issues. It obviously needs to be driven by consent. There's definitely value to that data, though. And what we've seen so far in our research is that if you want to get an app and you want to get it for free, then you won't hesitate to say, yes, sure, I understand the terms and conditions. There's not a lot of scrutiny there. I think, I can't remember who it was, but one firm put in all kinds of babble in there just to see if anybody read it, and they got through 100,000 signatures before anybody read it. So The regulation needs to be there and it needs to be clear. But I think also the main control really is reputation. I think as soon as anybody does overstep the mark in terms of using data and that gets out, that's actually what will be the most effective control.
And Tracy, when you can download at the TAC what speed a car's been doing every year it's registered?
Oh, we hope we don't actually have to download. We hope that the car will just take over the actual, the whole activity, I suppose, of driving. And so there will be no need to speed because, in fact, the trip, you'll know that the trip time before you leave, you'll say, oh, I want to go to work today. And they'll say, well, it's going to take you 24 minutes. So that the car will then actually just through GPS, travel on an automated, speed limit map. And the reality is that, you'll no longer be in an environment where enforcement and the regulation is what's controlling you personally. So it's quite freeing in terms of where we're heading in the future, I think, in terms of transport, rather than putting more onus on the driver. It's actually freeing you up to do other things and be free of some of that, I suppose, that the big brother that's sitting over the top of you even right now.
So basically, folks, the motor vehicle insurance industry is about to be wiped out if it wasn't for climate change giving you hail damage every now and then. Is that what you're saying? Is that where the innovation's heading to?
Well, I think, and this is where I'm no expert, but I suspect insurance is going to be a major component of it, but it may not be the individuals, because another part of these mega trends is that we're looking for very much a shared economy, where rather than the individual owning a car, we're going to have people like Uber, and in Europe you're seeing BMW go into the go-share car market, etc. So it won't be individuals that are being insured, but it will be big commercial entities.
I think, I'll ask, there is a question that verges on that that's come from the floor. How do you program ethical decision-making into automated cars?
It's a really good question, and you struggle with, does a car protect its occupants or does it protect others surrounding it, such as pedestrians, bicyclists. The vehicle manufacturers are really leading this debate right now, and Mercedes, in their latest S-Class, have pretty much said that their job is to protect the person that buys the car in the first instance. So it will protect the vehicle occupants in the first instance. That doesn't mean that a car isn't and won't be programmed to have a hierarchy, and it will be a learning machine. It will understand what's happening in the environment and the sort of decision making it needs to make. But in the first instance, it does seem that vehicle manufacturers are sort of, I suppose, voting with their feet about where that issue is going. And it doesn't seem to me that governments or regulation has had much of a role in that as yet.
I think when you kind of come back and think about that whole experience, the discussions that we've had is that the technology only needs to be as good as the best driver. Mm. It actually won't eliminate accidents in themselves. It will reduce them, but there will obviously be some failures and some risk associated with it. But imagine a world where you've got vehicles on the road that are the best driver.
Yeah.
And so it depends what standard you're wanting to deliver out, and then that sort of ethics in around the decision making becomes perhaps a little bit easier if you take the lens in around what you're wanting to achieve.
Mm. And if you think of some of the issues, so vehicle manufacturers are making decisions fairly much autonomously, independent of each other right now, but in the not too distant future, cars and people can be connected just through things like mobile phones. So a car will know that you're at a pedestrian crossing, as an example, because if it allows data sharing, that it will be able to detect you're there. Similar with motorcyclists, it will detect that a motorcyclist is within range of the car. So to some degree, the issues we face now are probably going to be resolved fairly quickly, but to some degree, manufacturers have to actually get out there and do things to start resolving the issues and start pushing the issues to some degree.
I'm just thinking, if it comes to the point of a car having to decide he's got to hit either the journalist or the TAC executive, the journalist isn't going to look good. No, more than likely. That technological side of it, we've got a question about whether regulation is an inhibitor, or maybe you flick that on the other side. Can regulation actually be an accelerator of innovation?
Now, I can give a little bit of an answer to that. That is a particularly pertinent question right now. I think what I've been pleased to see, and I'm not across the details of it, but I think ASIC has recently put out a consultation about this concept of a regulatory toolbox. Is that what it is?
Or sandpit.
Sandpit. So I think regulators are very much working in the spirit of acknowledging that to allow innovation to flourish, to deliver good results for consumers, they need to create a safe space where financial services companies can test things. So I think that's really useful, and I think it's a really, really good sign. So again, it's very early days for that. Tracy, you might have a little bit more knowledge about how that's actually working out.
Yeah, so I think many of the governments are actually thinking about how to actually set that up to encourage the innovation for periods of time, and that it lets you put in place, say, a principle-based regulation, because it doesn't become prescriptive, and let you get in there and play around a bit to actually see how the environment will respond. And I think that will happen more and more, because governments are in the same position as corporates, right? The world's moving really quickly, and if you take the Uber example, here's something that happened that was illegal, but based on where the regulation was, and there were different ways in terms of response, and we're seeing the regulation follow in sort of quite slowly after the worldwide innovation has occurred. And when we sort of speak to governments, that it's certainly very well recognised in this sort of experimentation, sort of greenfield playing, where it will be safe in terms of the testing and then sort of quickly getting things through.
Let me extrapolate that question then, and live dangerously by throwing a very broad one to the whole panel. Beyond regulation, what stops innovation? What's preventing us making the most of the innovation in each of your fields? Go.
I'm happy to start. So what we typically see is essentially, what's the best way to phrase it? The DNA of the organisation is what stops innovation. There's a kind of a tissue rejection of things that are new and things that are different, things that require a bit of risk, maybe some investment, and you don't see an immediate turnaround, you don't see an immediate benefit. So there's definitely a sort of a natural tendency for, you know, large corps to struggle a bit with innovation. I can't leave it there. I mean, the kind of the solution to that generally is to sort of try and do your innovation at arm's length to some extent. So yes, there's plenty of sort of idea generation that goes on, but quite often they're killed at the kind of the incubation stage. So looking after that incubation stage with maybe even a different entity, maybe even a different building, certainly a kind of something with a different culture that enables that sort of innovation to foster and grow.
That's within the corporate beast.
Yes.
More broadly then in the industry, ideas?
I think maybe perhaps it's a, I think someone mentioned earlier partnerships, and perhaps that's in the innovation space. It seems to me that a lot that can be gained is in partnering up with organisations, whether it be a community group on the ground or Stone and Chalk, which I think IAG is supporting that tech hub. But, and I think now that organisations are realising that they can't do this alone, I think perhaps that was one of the barriers that organisations thought they could stand alone and do this, you know, nail the innovation challenge, if you like. And I think that's not the case anymore. We're certainly seeing a lot more organisations looking to partner up with other groups and organisations that are really innovative and agile. So, and I think maybe, again, Tracy, you'd probably have a comment on this, but I see that as being a way that larger organisations can start to overcome some of the legacy issues that they've got that might have been a bit of a barrier.
Sam, within the TAC, I mean, I can think of a couple of innovations off the top of my head that I don't think you've done here. Centreline separation on two-lane roads. Great innovation story, yeah. Very quickly. Queensland, New South Wales started it. Queensland on the Bruce Highway. Head-on's a big problem. High speed, two lanes. Areas where the shoulder of the road is broad enough, they shrink the shoulder and have a metre centreline. a metre wide centre line. Road toll dropped from 53 to 5.
Yep.
Why haven't you done that?
Well, we have, not as extensively as on the Bruce, but we have actually done quite a bit of it, and what we're actually heading to on this Towards Zero strategy that I was just talking about, in fact, looking to go to the next step. And if you drive through Sweden, just happen to be doing that, you'll see this thing called centreline barrier, which just is basically, if you've got an 80k per hour road or higher, that will be what separates you from head-ons. It's actually a permanent barrier, and really that's what we're looking to do in Victoria. But if you're asking really what is the biggest barrier, and the barrier to exactly that sort of innovation, it is actually the road user itself. It's the individuals in the system who don't perceive they're at high risk. They don't perceive, in that case, they're at high risk from a head-on crash. They're happily approaching at basically 200 kilometres an hour, 100 kilometres each vehicle, passing within a metre of each other and thinking it's a perfectly safe situation. No different to going a bit over the speed limit. We've got technology right now that can easily let people know that they're going over the speed limit, and if they want the technology, that will inhibit them from going over it. But there is absolutely no demand. And one of the reasons I said we need to partner with other parts of society that is going to benefit, such as productivity, mobility, the environment in terms of vehicle automation, is that safety in itself doesn't sell. Individuals are not calling out for this. We've actually really got to find ways of giving it to them.
So, and that can be applied to all areas. The client, the customer, the end person has to want it, whatever the innovation is. There's a question aimed at Tracy. Do people want intimacy with or from their insurer? Just because an insurer can see what TV shows we watch, what we eat for breakfast, doesn't mean people want it.
So I think the customer testing has shown, showing that, yes, people do want to have a relationship and build trust with the insurer. I think we see a lot of that in terms of the feedback, and Vicky's sort of raised that through as being part of the culture. In terms of being understood and understood what you're buying, and having the confidence when it comes at the time of the claim to actually feel that you're going to be protected, then yes. To enable the insurance company to deliver that, there has to be this sort of level of knowledge associated with the person that they're dealing with. So we do get a lot of customer feedback now. I think if you're asking the question, do you want to be getting an email from an insurer every 30 seconds in terms of every... No, I don't think that's the type of interaction that we're talking about. But it is the ability to engage in a meaningful way for what matters to the individual, and I think any organisation is sort of looking in terms of how they'll do that. I think the Internet of Things, even in terms of some of the Nest kind of things going in, is the initial usage where people use it and then drop off, is that there's kind of this how do you keep people focused and engaged and wanting to use it, and the way that you do that is through understanding the customer.
Can I just add, so we definitely see that customer is the new black, essentially. There's a lot of focus from our clients on customers and this awful phrase, liquid expectations, but basically customers having higher and higher expectations of what will be provided to them, either because of the phone that they've got that's so sort of at their fingertips or anything really. But certainly that kind of idea of intimacy with any product or service is definitely much higher than it used to be. Mm. I think people's expectations are much higher than they used to be.
But, businesses have been saying that forever. Oh, we really care about customers. I've heard it all my life. And it's not true.
If I could add something, I think Tracy touched on it really well when she talked about how seamless Uber is. And I think probably all of us have used Uber, and it really is quite extraordinary. It is a delight to use Uber compared to a taxi most of the time. And I think that's the thing is, to me, the key question is, how can any product really be designed that just makes someone's life easier? It should be really simple. Does this product or does it not make someone's life easier? Can it be trusted? And that really should be the end of the story, if you like. So what do we need to do? How do we need to use innovation to create that result?
So if your industry can use all the technology you've got, all the big data and analytics and all the actuaries you've got, and you know everything about me if you wanted to use the data you've got, and come up and say, well, look, at this stage of your life with this, that and the other thing, this is the health insurance you actually need and here's a really good price for it. This is your home insurance or whatever. But no one's doing it.
Well, we're working on it, I think, would be the answer, because and this is where I say that we're on the cusp of it, right? So this technology is developing, big data, kind of the last 2, 3, 4 years. The ability to actually bring that information in, extract the insights and do something with it is the challenge, right? And you've got traditional operating models that are moving and having a think about how they need to organise to deliver just that. And we're seeing startups do that. So Uber is an example of being a startup more broadly, who doesn't have the legacy type systems in around in terms of shifting these big organisations into some of the other, you know, another way of delivering, which is why partnerships become so important in terms of that. But we're on the cusp. I'd say we're on the cusp of that being happening.
Can I say something too? I think. Certainly when we talk about innovation, we do tend to frame it up through the prism of technology and data and big data. I'd also like to just make the point that sometimes innovation is something as simple as when a flood has gone through a town, being on the ground with a caravan giving out grocery vouchers, which a lot of the insurers actually do. Now, that might not be technology, but to me that's innovation. That's an innovative customer-centric approach. It's actually making people's lives easier. People suddenly don't have a fridge, they don't have any food, so insurers are there on the ground within 12 hours with vouchers for Coles and Woolies and with blankets and with clothes for the kids. Now, that didn't happen 20 years ago. It happens now. Every time there's a natural disaster, insurers are on the ground almost as soon as the emergency services are, and that's, to me, that's innovation. I think that's an extraordinary thing that's really, really only happened probably in the last 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, and I think I'd add, when one of the East Coast lows, and I think we had 40, 50,000 claims come in associated with that, and we said, well, we can either deal with this traditionally in the way that we've always done it, or we can actually have a think about a challenge to say, how can we settle 90% of these claims in 90 days, right? So you think about that from a customer experience perspective, and I'd call out one thing associated with that. Food spoilage went viral during that event because there was quite a long time that power was out, and it went social media everywhere in terms of what's happening with the food spoilage. Does my insurer cover food spoilage or not? How do I lodge a claim? And our traditional sort of channels in terms of lodging a claim, so we had people who didn't have houses any longer who couldn't get through on the phones because we were being smashed with people wanting to find out what was happening with food spoilage. So we were able to respond in terms of social media to get the message out, to enable those sort of claims to come through in a very quick way by building some very quick services in the back end, in the middle of the event, and in fact settle those claims automatically through an app once we had them, which we built within a week. So I think we're seeing elements of how we can actually think about the delivery and around the service model in a very different context with what's available to us today, and then have a think once we take those experiments out, where we're trialling these types of things, which is broadly across partnerships, to then productionise them on a much bigger scale.
And with the Internet of Things, Guy's smart fridge will be loading up a drone with a fresh bottle of milk and delivering it personally.
Not just milk.
The vets.
They'll be lifting those cows that were stuck on the top of the hill in New Zealand overnight. Just vroom. Oh, look, we are out of time. I hate this. I've got to squeeze in one more specific question for Sam. As an economist, the price message in costs, you can see big changes coming in technology for cars. Yet, any fool on a motorbike knows he's going to come off, and it's cheaper. The price message, the market message of riding a push bike or a motorbike is, yeah, there's absolutely no good technology involved, and yet it's cheap. Does insurance have to change that? Have you got to start pricing bikes and motorbikes off the road?
We see all road users as legitimate. And so they've got a right to be there. They've got a right to use the road system. We all do have to take responsibility, however, for the level of risk we're travelling at. Whether pricing of insurance is the way to actually get people to take that responsibility for the risk they face when they're travelling on the roads, I'm not sure it's the best method. You will get a lot of mode movement, but that's not necessarily positive, and you just shift the risk sometimes to another area. So we've seen other jurisdictions do it, particularly with motorcycles. It hasn't always ended well for them. So I think you need a lot of consideration. I think morally what we're really trying to do is make the system safe for everybody to travel on, no matter what mode they're using at what time. And as I suppose government agencies and insurance agencies looking after people who are injured, what we know is that we've got an opportunity to make the system safe, no matter how you use it or when you use it, and that's the opportunity we need to take, rather than, I suppose, punitive measures which say we're going to punish you because you've made certain choices.
Could you at least confiscate motorbikes that have really loud exhaust pipes up and down the street? No, we won't go there. Ladies and gentlemen, I hate having to stop this because there's a lot of other good questions, but I have to. We have to finish on time because the bus for the airport departs at 5:20. So for just now, could you please thank Tracy, Guy, Sam and Vicky for a great panel.